As you leave here this weekend, I just want to tell you one thing. As you move back with new motivation, new inspiration, new knowledge, a whole new perception of things, perhaps as a result of this convention, I want to encourage you to continue to dream. It is really important that you paint and visualize tremendous dreams for your future. If we could be in room 305 this morning of Concord, New Hampshire High School, that's the classroom where Krista McAuliffe taught for many years. There is one reminder remaining there of the Space Challenger disaster of January 1986. And it's a picture, a poster, of those astronauts who lost their lives with their names underneath. And at the bottom of the poster, there is one sentence. It says, if you have a dream, don't let anything dim it. It's important to dream. And I want to encourage you to really, really dream big. But there's one problem with dreams, and that is they will drift off and disappear and never become reality in your life unless you do something about it, something specific. The people whose dreams come true have understood and learned that there is a specific formula that they must follow. And it's very simple. It's not easy, but it's simple. And the formula consists of building a ladder for your dreams. Those people who accomplish and achieve and seemingly have dreams that come to fulfillment have understood and learned how to build a ladder to their dreams. And so in the few minutes that we have together this morning, I want to build this ladder for you. But I must point out to you, it's a ladder that must be built one rung at a time. That's how you build a ladder to paint the side of your house. And that's how you build a ladder to have your dreams come true. The exciting thing about building this ladder is it comes with a money-back guarantee. In other words, if you build it and do a good job of building those rungs, one rung at a time, every dream will come true, money-back guarantee. So let me just start at the bottom with you, and we'll build this ladder up to the top. The first rung at the base of the ladder simply says this: think the right kind of thoughts. Because what you think about all day long has a way of becoming reality in your life. Following her freshman year at Princeton University, Brooke Shields, who got straight A's all the way through except a B in philosophy, was asked about the B in philosophy. And she said this: my problem with philosophy is that each philosopher sounds right to me, even though they all contradict each other. And she's right. If you go back and read the writings of the philosophers from the beginning of time, they don't agree on anything except this first rung of our ladder. What you think about all day long ultimately is going to become a reality. And you observe that every great act, every act of kindness, every hospital that's been launched, every university, every philanthropic work started as a little thought in the mind of a man or a woman and fleshed itself out into action. And by the same token, every act of violence, every act of evil, every war that's been started, every murder that's been perpetrated began in the mind of a man or a woman as a thought, and it later took seed and became an action. It is simply an irrefutable fact of life that we are what we think. You sow a thought and you reap an action. You sow an action and you reap a habit. You sow a habit and you reap a character. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. And so your destiny and my destiny begins with what we think about all day long, because it's going to ultimately become an action in your life. And while we are discussing this important first rung, I want to say to you, don't, in your mind, limit what you can accomplish with your life. That's where most people stop. It's right here in their mind. That's where they stop. And never go beyond what their mind says they can accomplish. Many people you see accept their perceived limitations, their mental limitations, and they never live up to their true potential. You know, they are like trained fleas that you see at the county fair. I don't know whether you've ever gone there, but you will notice that in the glass canister where these fleas are, there is no lid to keep the fleas contained. And so the obvious question is, why don't they just fly away and disappear? Well, it goes back to when the flea trainer began working with them. He put them in the glass canister, put a dome on top, The fleas began jumping up, bashing their little flea brains on that clear plastic lid, and after enough et cetera and headaches like this, the fleas stopped jumping quite so high so they could enjoy their newfound comfort. And at that point, the trainer could remove the lid, and the fleas now were held inside that jar no longer by a plastic dome, but by a mindset that said, so high and no more. Unfortunately, many people are just like those trained fleas. Since at some point early in their lives they were placed under hindering circumstances or had limitations placed on them, now that they're out on their own, they're fully functioning adults, they still are like those fleas, refusing to crash through that mental barrier, that mental horizon, and become everything that they can become. And so I want to ask you a very personal question today. In your line of work, in your endeavor, in your career, what are your capabilities? I don't even know any of you, but I can tell the answer to you right now. What are your capabilities? No one knows. Nobody knows. And therefore, no one, including yourself, should be feeding your mind with life-limiting thoughts. It should never happen to you. I don't know whether you remember, but it was close to 50 years ago that Johnny Weissmuller, known to you late-night movie buffs as Tarzan, was called the greatest swimmer the world had ever seen. Nobody will ever break Johnny Weissmuller's records, people said. He held more than 50 of them. Well, do you know who's breaking them today? 12-year-old girls. That's who's doing it. In 1954, it was still said nobody can break the 4-minute barrier in running the mile. Dr. Roger Bannister did it. Since that time, over 500 men have broken the 4-minute barrier since Roger Bannister did it, because the mental horizon was shattered. So I want to encourage you, as we plant the first rung on the ladder, to remember it always, because it is built around thinking the right kind of thoughts. There's a second rung on the ladder that's equally as important. And this rung simply says, say the right kind of words, because what you say also has a way of becoming a reality in your life. You know, the world out there that we are living in is not a playground. It is a battleground. All of us suffer from stress. But there's something about people who come along our lives, in our lives, who understand the power of the spoken word. Those few people who understand that encouragement is inspiring others with renewed courage, spirit, or hope to spur them on. In the classical Greek, the word encourage has to do with cheering on the troops who are about to enter battle. And every day, everyone we encounter is fighting a battle. It was Mark Twain who says, most of us can run pretty well all day on one good compliment. He understood that encouragement is as vital to the soul as oxygen is to the body. The great industrialist Charles Schwab said, I have yet to find a person, however exalted their station, who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than under a spirit of criticism. It was James many, many years ago who said, we can steer and guide a horse with a tiny little piece of metal in his mouth. And a giant ship on the ocean can be controlled by a tiny little rudder in the water. But he said the human tongue is untamable. That is the one thing that men and women have never learned to tame. And he's right. Down the road here at SeaWorld, which I hope you'll have a chance to visit, you'd have an opportunity to see what men and women have done in taming porpoises and killer whales and dolphins, sea lions and seals, otters, penguins. Men and women have learned to train Flipper and Shamu and Trigger and Lassie and Rin Tin Tin. But the one thing men and women have never learned to tame is that slippery piece of mucous membrane lodged front and center behind two white rows of sparkling ivory, situated in the lower front position of the human face. And that's the tongue. But for our dreams to come true, we've got to understand that until we learn to master the use of our tongue, not only in our professional relationships, but every relationship of our life, it is then that we have a chance for our dreams to come true. You know who has mastered this? You know who really understands this rung far better than human beings? I'll tell you who it is. It's the Canada geese that wing their way south every year from north to the warmer climates of the south. We used to live in New Jersey and were fascinated in watching these birds as they flew over our home in South Jersey. We miss that even to this day. And scientists love to study those birds. They have discovered, for example, that the bird who is flying at the head of that V formation, bucking into the wind, which obviously is the toughest job, will only remain there for about 20 minutes. And then he'll rotate to the back and another bird will come up to take his position, obviously to relieve the pressure, so no one bird has to carry that tough assignment too long. Scientists are also convinced that when one of those birds is injured down on the ground, unable to fly, he will never be left there alone because one or two other birds will stay with him until he's strong enough to fly again. And scientists are also convinced that when those Canada geese are up in the air, making those honking sounds, winging their way south, they are not just making meaningless bird noises, but they're actually cheering, encouraging, and rooting for each other. And in my sanctified imagination, I can kind of picture it like this, and I'm about to make a fool of myself. Honk, honk, you can do it. Honk, honk, we're going to make it. Honk, honk, hang in there, we're almost at our destination. And scientists are convinced that these birds can fly 71% further this way than they ever could flying alone. This past spring, the Detroit Pistons successfully won their second consecutive NBA championship, a very unique accomplishment. Very few teams have ever done that, which certainly would rank them as one of the best NBA teams of all time. The coach of that team, Chuck Daly, who is a good friend for many, many years, was asked about his success. People wanted to talk to him about some of his thoughts and his philosophies and, you know, over the years, things that have impacted him. And Chuck one day said to a writer this. He said, "Let me tell you a story. I'm teaching a philosophy class years ago at Duke University. Some students, some athletes. We meet in a room between two handball courts. And I'm in there one day and I'm telling everyone, you can get on the players, that's okay. Because once you leave the court, it's all over, it's forgotten. This football player gets right up and says, that's not right. It's not forgotten. Whatever you say is remembered. You can't get on a player one minute and expect him to forget it in the next minute." The guy caught me by surprise, said Chuck, but that statement, what he had to say that day, has meant as much to me as anything I've ever heard in my life. I learned more in those few minutes than at any other time in my whole life. Now, the third rung of this ladder states this. You've got to be specific in goal setting. You see, a clear-cut, definite goal is a powerful motivating force in our lives. And without goals written down, short-term, mid-range, and long-term, we're not going to accomplish anything with our lives and our careers. It just isn't going to happen. It would be wonderful to say that we're all powerfully motivated and driven, and every day we're striving to reach something, but without goals, it's not going to happen. And we need goals, specific goals, in four areas of our lives. In the spiritual area, in the family area, in the professional area, and in the area of health. We've got to have them. Clear cut, written down, definite. Not vague, but specific. Obviously, I don't have time to develop all that. Let me just share with you one quick little incident that probably helped formulate my approach to goals in this professional area better than anything that's ever happened in my life. In my first year with the 76ers, the owner of the team called me up one day. I was a brand new executive. And he said, "Pat, if you're going to have any success at all in professional sports as an executive, you have got to ask yourself two questions every minute of every day. Question number one, what are you doing right now to help the 76ers win more games? And secondly, what are you doing right now to help the 76ers sell more tickets? And if what you're doing does not fall under one of those headings, you're on a detour, you're on a side road, you're drifting, and you've got to get yourself back under the main banner of what you're trying to accomplish." The most powerful lesson in goal setting I've ever received.
Joe Paterno, the head football coach at Penn State, put it this way. He said, set short-term goals and you'll win games. Set long-term goals and you'll win championships. And he was right. He understands, I think, that a goal is a dream with a deadline. It makes us do things that we never would do otherwise. But I need to undergird this by telling you that the only goal setters who really make things happen are those who understand the importance of discipline. That's what it takes. To be more specific, self-discipline. Bum Phillips, the former NFL coach, said, the only discipline that lasts is self-discipline. And I want to give you the best definition of self-discipline I've ever heard in my life. It came from Bobby Knight, the basketball coach at Indiana University, who said, discipline is doing what needs to be done. Discipline is doing it when it needs to be done. Discipline is doing it the best it can be done. And discipline is doing it that way every time you do it. The fourth rung on the ladder that has to be in place if our dreams are going to come true says simply, you are responsible. You and I are responsible. Now, there's an insidious mindset that is sweeping through our country that differs with that. It is a mindset that says, I am not responsible because you don't know about my environment, and you don't know about my parents, and you don't know about my educational background, and you don't know about the fact that I had poor potty training when I was a baby, and you don't know the fact that I had to eat spinach when I was 5 years old. And as a result of this, I'm not responsible. You run into it every day. We have 12 kids. I run into it every day. Listen, our biggest job as parents is to get across the point to them day after day after day that they're responsible. They're responsible for every decision they make. They're responsible to keep their rooms neat and pick their clothes up and put their baseball gloves in the right place and not leaving baseball cards lying all over everything. They're responsible. Not us. They are. And some kids never do grasp that concept, and 50 years later, they still aren't responsible. You and I are responsible for every decision that we make. I remember in 1986, in Philadelphia, we had won the first pick in the draft, and we were going to take a big center from North Carolina named Brad Daugherty. We brought him to Philadelphia to interview him. If you follow college basketball, you're aware of the impact that Dean Smith, the coach at Carolina, has on every one of his players. It's enormous, a tremendous relationship that Dean has with all these athletes over a period of 30 years. And we were curious about that, so we asked Brad Daugherty when he came to Philadelphia, what is the story, Brad? What goes on in Chapel Hill? And Brad said instantly, from the time we walk on the campus as freshmen, Coach Smith teaches us that we are responsible for getting up in the morning and getting to class on time by ourselves. And we are responsible to get to practice every day. And we are responsible to get our degree. And we are responsible to go out into society and be contributing members. We are responsible. And it was also in that summer of 86 that there was a raging controversy about universities taking young athletes, using them, never leading them to a degree, and when their eligibility is up, they dump them. And John Thompson, the shy retiring coach at Georgetown, was asked about that. And in his typical humble way, John said, I'm sick and tired of hearing you cause Johnny to flunk. I tell my players, chump, the education is here. I'm going to support you for the education, but it is your responsibility to get the education for yourself. Mike Krzyzewski, the highly successful coach at Duke University, understands this. He said the most mature human being is the one who takes responsibility for all his actions and can say, this was done well and I did it, and that was done poorly and I did it. If you can take responsibility for both, you can go on to the next thing because you're more even keeled. My outlook comes from West Point when I was a cadet. My players probably get tired of all my West Point stories, but I tell them when you're a plebe at West Point, the upperclassmen yell at you a lot, and you have only three answers. Yes, sir, no, sir, and no excuses, sir. So you can be walking out of a room, and your shoes are supposed to be shined all the time, and you're with your roommate who walks through a puddle of water, and splashes some of it on your shoes. 2 steps later, an upperclassman says, "Halt." He looks down at your shoes and asks, "Why are your shoes so muddy?" And you can't just say, "Hey, man, I was walking down here and my roommate's..." Nah, you can't do that. You have to say, "No excuses, sir," because the fact is, your shoes are muddy. Whose responsibility? Your responsibility. So, when you're out on the basketball court and you throw a pass, it's your responsibility. I hate players of mine who say, "Hey, man, you were supposed to catch that." And I say to them, "Did you help the other player get in the right position or in the right frame of mind to catch the ball?" The 5th rung of our ladder says this, and I hope you won't think poorly of me, lest you think I'm talking to a room full of 8-year-olds. But the 5th rung simply says, seek out the right kind of friends. Because the people that you surround yourself with all day long will ultimately determine what becomes of you. We wisely tell our children that their friends will have profound effects upon them. But listen, our friends will have equally profound effects upon us. Charlie Jones, the great motivational speaker from Pennsylvania, has said this: 5 years from today, every one of us will be the same people we are today, except for 2 things. The books that we read and the people that we meet. Casey Stengel, the former great manager of the Yankees, understood the power of associations on a ballplayer's attitude. When Billy Martin started his managing career, he remembered Casey's advice to him. Casey said there would be 15 players on your team who will run through a wall for you, 5 who will hate you, and 5 who are undecided. And then Stengel added, "Billy, when you make out your rooming list, always room your losers together. Never room a good guy with a loser. Because the losers who stay together will blame the manager for everything. But it won't spread if you keep them isolated." Hey, listen, it's just like apples in a barrel. You can take the most beautiful bushel of red, juicy apples from the state of Oregon, but if in the middle of them there's one rotten one, in an incredibly brief period of time, the one rotten one will make all the good ones rotten. All the good ones in the world will never make the rotten one good. And that will spread through those apples so quickly that within a few days you're going to have to pitch the whole barrel. It's exactly the same with our relationship with people. The 6th rung of our ladder says, learn how to handle your hurts. Learn how to take those setbacks and those disappointments and those failures, those times of tragedy, and turn them around and make them your strengths. The people who see their dreams come true have mastered this concept, hard as it is. They understand that there is no gain without pain, and that setbacks really do pave the road for comebacks. Some of you ladies here this weekend are wearing beautiful pearls around your neck, and I think I can best illustrate this 6th rung by reminding you that pearls are the product of pain. For some unknown reason, the shell of an oyster gets pierced, and an alien substance, a grain of sand perhaps, slips inside. And on the entry of that foreign irritant, all the resources within the tiny sensitive oyster rush to that spot of irritation with a healing fluid called mother of pearl that they begin to wrap layer by layer by layer around the grain of sand. Without the interruption, without the irritation, it would have remained dormant. After a period of time, the irritant is covered and the wound is healed by a pearl. No other gem has so fascinating a history. It's a symbol of stress, a healed wound, a precious tiny jewel that was conceived through irritation, born of adversity, nursed by adjustments. And had there been no wounding, no irritating interruption, there would have been no pearl. Some oysters are never wounded, and those who seek for gems simply toss them aside because they're fit only for an oyster stew. Helen Keller was right. She said, face your deficiencies and acknowledge them, but do not let them master you. Let them teach you patience, sweetness, and insight. The 7th rung on our ladder, as we move to the top, says this: if you want your dreams to come true, you've got to go the second mile. You've got to learn the principle of the second mile. What that means is you've got to do twice what's expected of you. In other words, hard work is what makes dreams a reality. This whole concept is not new. 20 centuries ago, Rome was the dominant nation on earth. They conquered every land within sight. One of the nations that they conquered was the little land of Israel on the Mediterranean Sea. And when they went into a country, they immediately enslaved all of the citizens. So in capturing Israel, all of the Jewish citizens were immediately enslaved. And one of the rules that the Roman army had was that at any time, they could stop one of those Jews and order him to carry the military equipment 1 mile down the hot, dusty road. The Jews hated it. They chafed under this. They rebelled. Thousands of them were killed, but the rules stayed in effect. And at that point of time, just in that period, Christ came to earth with his teaching ministry. And one day, he was teaching on a hillside, sloping down across the grassy banks down to the Sea of Galilee. And it was obviously a question and answer session. And one of the questions that was asked, you could kind of picture the little farmer putting his hand up and asking the question, said, "Master, this rule that the Romans have about us having to carry the military equipment down the road 1 mile, we don't like it. Do we have to do it?" And the master quickly said, "No, you don't have to do it." Well, I could just see the hillside. I mean, these people were up slapping high fives and low fives and juking and jiving. They loved it because their leader said, "No, you don't have to do it." Then there was a pause. And he said, "No, I don't want you to carry it 1 mile down the road. I want you to carry it 2. Total silence on the hillside. Well, at that point in history, the principle of the second mile was introduced here on planet Earth. I do not have to remind you that it is no more popular today than it was 20 centuries ago. It has not caught on. But I want to encourage you and recommend to you that in your sphere of influence, that you introduce it. I mean, can you imagine in every husband-wife relationship, if each party did twice what's expected of them, what would happen? Or how about in parent-children relationships, each party did double, twice? Or employer-employee, or coach and athlete, general and private, I mean, right across all facets of society. Listen, it's incredible to think what might happen if this principle was launched. It comes down to doing twice what's expected of you. And over the years, many people have grasped this. They understood it. My boyhood idol, the great left fielder for the Boston Red Sox, Ted Williams, understood that. They used to say in the height of his career he was the greatest natural hitter who ever lived. But Ted just scoffed at that, and he said it's practice that makes a hitter. Conscientious practice. I say that Ted Williams has hit more balls than any guy living, except maybe Ty Cobb. I don't say it to brag. I just state it as a fact. From the time I was 11 years old, I've taken every possible opportunity to swing at a ball. I've swung, and I've swung, and I've swung. Larry Bird, the great Celtics star, following his third consecutive MVP award in 1986, was asked how he planned to spend the offseason. And Larry said, "Well, I plan to take a 2-week break after the playoffs, and then really work hard this summer. I've got to work on a few left-handed moves to make my game stronger. I'll come back next year and have 4 or 5 new moves, and they won't be able to stop me." And that's from the greatest player at that point that the game had ever known. Following a concert, Beethoven was approached by a gushing matron who said, "Mr. Beethoven, your music is magic. You are a genius." And Beethoven looked at her and said, "Lady, you practice the piano 8 hours a day for 40 years, and you'll be a genius too." I got to tell you about one other who understands this. I watched him on television last night. He's having a fantastic career. Listen, he may be the most valuable player in the American League, and he's 43 years old. His name is Carlton Fisk. He is doing things at that age that no player in history has ever thought of doing. Listen, most catchers, by the time they're 30, are gnarled up into little lumps and can't even walk. But here is Carlton Fisk. And recently in Sports Illustrated, there was an article about him, and the writer Peter Gammon said, "There is no compromise in Carlton Fisk. And he says things not to impress, but to explain, to provide some rationale for his unwavering drive. Fisk says, I remember talking to Carl Yastrzemski. He has had one of the greatest seasons ever in 1967 after working out with a trainer who beat the heck out of him. I asked Yaz why he never went back to the guy again afterward, and his face was pained when he answered me. Too hard. I didn't want to go through it again. That always stuck with me. Success has no shortcuts. Following the Battle of Waterloo, in which Napoleon's dreams for conquering the world had ended, he was asked about it. And he said, we had better equipment, better leadership, better strategy, better weapons. But the British fought 5 minutes longer. That's what he said. I want you to keep this simple fact of physics in mind. Water will boil at 212 degrees. But at 211 degrees, it's still just hot water. One extra little degree can make the difference between a liquid languishing in a pot and a bubbling cauldron of power, a full head of steam. That's what Anthony Newley, the actor, meant when he said, big shots are little shots who keep on shooting. That's what Paul Harvey meant when asked the secret of his success, I get up when I fall down. And the last rung in this ladder that must be planted in there firmly and strong at the very top says, live your life by the faith phenomenon. And you say to me, what does that mean? How do I do that? Well, you've already demonstrated it many times this weekend. For example, you sat on these chairs this morning. By faith, you had no idea whether they would hold you. You ate your breakfast this morning. By faith, you have no idea who prepared it. You do not know what was in it. You were not in the kitchen as the ingredients were being mixed. Some of you flew here, particularly the Miami group. You know, they flew up from Miami, probably went to the airport there in Miami, Air Apaloca or whatever it is that was coming up here. Said, listen, I'd like to buy one chance on your next flight to Orlando. It had no in-flight movies, although your life did flash before your eyes a few times. So what I'm saying is simply this. We demonstrate faith all day long, every day. And I want to encourage you to come face to face with the awesome reality there is a God who loves you and cares for you, who has a magnificent plan and purpose for your life. And as you plug yourself into that power that runs the universe, at that time and only at that time, as you commit to Him and let His power flow through your life, it's only at that point that you can start living up to 100% of your maximum potential and become everything that God intended you to be when He created you. And it's at that point that life takes on meaning and purpose and significance, and your ladder is complete and you can start singing all of your dreams come true. And let me tell you who understood this very clearly. It's probably my all-time idol from history. One of the great passions in my life is the Civil War. I am a Civil War buff. Very obnoxious people. If you have run into one, you know what I'm talking about. But I think of all the Civil War personalities, my favorite would be a man by the name of Thomas Jonathan Jackson. In fact, we have named one of our Korean sons Thomas Jonathan. You would best recognize his name as General Stonewall Jackson, the immortal Confederate general who lost his life in 1863 following the Battle of Chancellorsville. The courage of this remarkable Civil War leader, Stonewall Jackson, in the midst of conflict, reinforces this ninth and final rung to every one of us. Historian Mark Grimsley wrote, a battlefield is a deadly place, even for generals. And it would be naive to suppose that Jackson never felt the animal fear of all beings exposed to wounds and death. But invariably, he displayed extraordinary calm under fire, a calm too deep and masterful to be mere pretense. His apparent obliviousness to danger attracted notice. And after the first Manassas battle in 1861, someone asked Jackson how he managed it. My religious belief teaches me to feel as safe in battle as in bed, Jackson explained. God knows the time for my death. I do not concern myself about that, but to be always ready, no matter where it may overtake me. And then Jackson added pointedly, that is the way all men should live. And then all would be equally brave.